China has emerged as one of the 21st century's most consequential nations, making it more important than ever to understand how the country is governed. Welcome to Pekingology, the podcast that unpacks China's evolving political system. I'm Jude Blanchette, the Freeman Chair in China Studies at CSIS, and this week I'm joined by Chenggang Xu, Senior Research Scholar at the Stanford Center on China's Economy and Institutions at Stanford University. Audio for this discussion comes from a public event we hosted with Chenggang at CSIS this week. We discuss his research and forthcoming book, Institutional Genes, The Origins of China's Institutions and Totalitarianism, forthcoming by Cambridge University Press. Well, good afternoon and welcome. My name is Jude Blanchette. I'm the Freeman Chair in China Studies here at CSIS. And I'm really delighted today to be hosting Chenggang Xu, who's a senior research scholar at Stanford Center for China's Economy and Institutions. This is just a real treat for me as a longtime fan of Chenggang's work, and here to talk about a forthcoming book, which is actually metastasizing into a large research project that Chenggang is doing. But the first part of this is called Institutional Genes, The Origins of China's Institutions and Totalitarianism. This will be published by Cambridge University Press later on this year at some point, but Chenggang was gracious enough to share some of the chapters of the book, and I thought it was such a stimulating, thought-provoking, path-breaking piece of work that we were just really delighted to host him here for a discussion. And I'll just say, as an armchair student of China, I remember one of the most important pieces of work I read that really shaped my thinking about China was one of Chenggang's articles, 2011, Fundamental Institutions of China's Reform and Development. That's how I first became aware of Chenggang's work, and have now read most of his work, and just it continues to provoke questions and I think shape the way I think about China. So Chenggang, just really thrilled and delighted to host you here, and really excited to talk about this this important new book.
Thank you so much, Jude, for having me.
So with the caveat that, of course, I haven't read the entire book because it's not fully, it's not all complete, but read what you sent me. You know, the first question I wanted to ask you is, it's just in some ways intuitive, but also rare to see the word totalitarian used to describe contemporary China. I think the view is, of course, that was a definition that fit during the Mao period, but starting with reform and opening in the late 1970s, that phase of China's political trajectory has ceased. And even under Xi Jinping, I don't see many people use the word totalitarian. So I wanted to start by asking, you know, I think the first sentence in the book says, the fundamental institution of contemporary China is communist totalitarianism with Chinese characteristics. We'll get into the Chinese characteristics later, but how do you conceptualize totalitarianism? What's your definition, and why do you think that's the best description of China's political institutions today?
Thank you so much for raising this fundamental question. The definition here I'm applying actually comes from Frederick and Brzezinski 1956 book, which is about totalitarianism. And by their definition, totalitarianism is a kind of institution which is completely, totally controlled by a party. That is the totalitarian party. And that party controls every aspect of the whole society. Concretely, it would include ideology, armed forces, the government, the business and organizations, and the legal institutions and the judicial institutions, and the propaganda means media. So everything in every aspect of the society is controlled by one party. And the reason today's China still fits with this definition is very simple. Actually, the definition is given by the Chinese Communist Party itself. So what the Chinese Communist Party claims is that the party leads everything. So the party leads everything means the party controls everything. And so the party leads everything. 东南西北中, 党政军民协, 党是领导一切的. So these words, party leads everything, was actually clearly made by Chairman Mao Zedong before the Cultural Revolution, and nowadays by Xi Jinping repeatedly, and also under the leadership of Xi Jinping. These words now are in the charter of the Chinese Communist Party. So this is the definition given by themselves.
If someone, a couple colleagues are in China right now, and if someone travels to China, it wouldn't necessarily have the direct observational feel of a totalitarian country, insofar as you would think there's sort of wide degrees of latitude for social behavior, maybe not political behavior. So is your definition of totalitarianism about an institutional arrangement, or is it about a sort of pattern of life? Because I think certainly being in China today, now this would depend on where you are. If you're a Uyghur in Xinjiang, I think that the feeling of totalitarianism would be much more present. But if you're a white-collar worker in Beijing, I think the difference between now and Maoist China or Stalinist Russia would be quite distinct. So I'm just trying to understand how we should think about totalitarianism as a aspiration by the party, as an institutional arrangement, or as a sort of de facto lived way of life, or maybe all three.
Right. So the part of the reason that people have thoughts about either totalitarianism fits or not fit with China is because in China, the largest part of the economy is the private sector. And most employees are in private firms. And associated with the private firms, there are a very large number of NGOs, so, and also foreign firms. So then people may argue that they are working in a private firm or in an NGO, therefore it's not a totalitarian regime. But the matter of fact is that all the firms, regardless of the legal ownership or legal definition of the ownership, they must have a Communist Party cell, and they are controlled by the Communist Party. Moreover, all the courts are controlled by the Communist Party, and the police, all the police forces are controlled by the Communist Party. All the NGOs are controlled by the Communist Party. So then it's a matter of the preference or the strategy of the party to allow you or not allow you to do whatever they think of. So when they wanted to be relaxed a little bit, then you feel more relaxed. But if they want to tighten up, then they have every mean, and actually legally they have every mean to do it. So the zero COVID policy, the implementation of the zero COVID policy, is an exhibition of their power.
Yeah, and I think that's a really important point, that the areas where there is tolerance or leeway is not because there are institutional barriers to the party asserting its authority. It's simply, as you say, a matter of the party's temporary preferences. But there's no real checks and balances.
Right.
There's no sort of endogenous actors or forces who can fundamentally constrain where the party wants to act.
Right. I also like to elaborate a little bit about the totalitarian party. The totalitarian party, the Chinese Communist Party, is a good example. A totalitarian party is not a party in the common sense. A party in the common sense, if I cite the definition by Max Weber, a party by common sense is that there are two features. One feature is that a political party is competing with other parties. So that's a political party. And the party exists within organizations. So that's definition number one. Definition number two is that the members of a political party are voluntary. So they voluntarily enter your party, the party, and voluntarily exit from the party. So a totalitarian party is going to violate all of these definitions. So it's not within an organization. It's not allowing for the existence of any other organization without its control. So it's above all the organizations, and it prohibits any other organization only in conditional on the leadership or control of the totalitarian party. The other organizations can exist, and also the members are not voluntary, particularly. Once you enter this party, you will not be allowed to exit.
Yeah, I guess in the case of, I think your point is correct. There has been an effort over the last decade for the Communist Party to get rid of members that it feels like are insufficiently loyal. So there is technically an exit strategy, and the simplest way to do it now would be to stop paying your party dues. And they would kick you out, but I think
that's a purge.
Your point is taken.
Yeah.
I wanted to ask you about how changes in academic interest following the collapse of the Soviet Union affected how we thought about China's trajectory.
Right.
Put another way, obviously, I think it makes intuitive sense that once the Soviet Union collapses, new PhD students are not going to be continuing to study autocratic systems, right?
Right.
It appeared as if we were entering into a fundamentally new paradigm, and scholars began to study, reform, post-totalitarian reform autocratic systems or democratization.
Right.
I'm curious how you think this abandonment of the study of dictatorship and autocratic systems affected how we thought about China. Asking it a slightly different way, if we had still had a large group of academics focused on studying dictatorship, would they potentially have seen something in China, even in that post-Soviet collapse period, where they might have given us a more accurate understanding of where China was heading?
Yeah, exactly. So if the academic world didn't move in the direction what we have seen in this recent three decades, then our understanding of China, understanding the nature of the Chinese regime, would be fundamentally different. And many of the mistakes would not be made. And the reason the research of the communist totalitarianism was abandoned was an illusion. So at that time, the illusion is that the communist totalitarianism was over. So that is the history. And the history is not going to come back. Also, when people portrayed the Chinese regime as an authoritarian regime, then there is an existing theory. In political science, it's called modernization theory. And by that theory, it argues that an authoritarian regime could be transformed peacefully into democracy as long as the economy grows. The argument is that when the economy grows, then you have a growth of the middle income class. And the middle income class would have interest to push forward democracy. And indeed, the Chinese economy was growing and was growing very fast. So therefore, there was a popular view that China would eventually being transformed into democracy because it was growing, because it was an authoritarian regime like South Korea, like Taiwan before the late 80s. So then China would be next, South Korea, next Taiwan. So it was going to move to democracy. And therefore, actually, the growth of China benefited hugely from the policy of the United States, particularly around the early 21st century.
To be fair, though, there were lots of, this wasn't just a case of the U.S. getting China wrong. There were lots of Chinese intellectuals
right.
in the 1990s who also
right.
saw this
right.
possibility of
right.
of transformation
right.
towards, you know, maybe a softer authoritarian system or even something more democratic.
Right.
And there were orthodox conservatives in the Communist Party who also worried that, you know, China's accession to the WTO would facilitate political liberalization. So it seems like it wasn't necessarily wrong of us to think that. Maybe what we missed is the counter-reform capabilities of the party, that once it essentially, it saw a movement in that direction of liberalization and pluralization, it reacted with retrenchment. I don't know what you think about that thesis.
Right, right. So here, I guess a key question is about the objective of the economic reform of the Chinese Communist Party. So I guess here the most serious wrong about understanding China is related to this question. So what is the objective of economic reform for the Chinese Communist Party? So actually Deng Xiaoping made it crystal clear in 1979. That's before any reform being launched yet. So in 1979, Deng Xiaoping made a public announcement for the four cardinal principles, means the four red lines for whatever is going to happen in the future. And among the four cardinal principles, number one is socialism. Number two is the leadership of the Communist Party. Number three is ideology, which is Marxism, Leninism, Mao Zedong thought. And number four is the proletariat dictatorship. So these four principles, none of the one would be touched upon. And then in 1982, when the reform just started, Deng Xiaoping made another public speech saying that the Chinese economic reform is the same as the Leninist new economic policy. So people just ignored what he said. So it's a new economic policy of Lenin. So then we have to understand what is the new economic policy of Lenin. So when Lenin proposed the so-called new economic policy, the purpose of that is for surviving of the newly established Soviet regime. So then for surviving, the Communist Party would allow for private sector, allow for market development. And then as long as the Communist Party found comfortable, found they are stable and they are strong enough, then they are going to launch the full-fledged socialist reform or revolution. So that is a strategy, but people just ignored that.
I want to turn to the book, and there's two concepts I first need to ask you to explain before we can move forward, and that is the concept of institutional genes.
Right.
And the second is this key idea of regionally decentralized totalitarianism. Let me start with the first. What is this framework of institutional genes? And related to that, how in your framework do institutions, if we're using the gene analogy, how do these replicate within across national boundaries, which in the case of the Soviet Union to China, but also within the Chinese context.
Right. So to explain the institutional genes, the concept of institutional genes, I have to refer to a existing famous theory by Douglas North. So that is the path dependence theory. The path dependence theory argues that the institution changes, and the institutional changes are depending on the path of the change, which means that history matters. Because Douglas North was an economic historian. So my idea of institutional genes is actually try to explain the mechanism of path dependence. So path dependence, in my view, is a black box. So basically, it tells us a tendency of institutional changes, but it didn't explain clearly why the transformation path matters. So here, the reason the transformation path matters is because they are basic institutional elements in every institution. And these basic elements are going to be produced and reproduced by the people who pushed forward institutional changes. And the reason they are going to reproduce the existing institutional genes is because their own interests. So for their own interests, they want to keep certain elements of the old institutions in the place. So moreover, here there is another important conceptual issue about institution. Institution here, what I mean by institution, would not only including the codes of the organizations or the code of behavior, it would also include the social consensus, because many of the behavior and way of organizing are not necessarily being codified, so people follow, and the reason people follow is because the existence of the social consensus. So if someone violates the social consensus, then you may be punished. So then this kind of a fundamental or basic elements of institutions are going to be produced and reproduced and going to repeat in history. But these kind of things are also, they themselves are going to change. Just like when we talk about the Chinese adapting totalitarianism from Soviet Russia. So that's from outside. So it doesn't mean that these institutional genes are going to be there forever. So they are evolving, but they have their own ways of evolving. So then we have to understand how these kind of things are going to evolve for policy reasons.
Next concept, and then we'll bring these two together, but then the next concept is this idea of regionally decentralized totalitarianism, you know, or totalitarianism with Chinese characteristics.
Right.
So you've already laid out a standard definition of totalitarianism. Right. I wonder if you can now, what's the regionally decentralized?
Right.
And what's interesting about it is I think intuitively we tend to think of totalitarianism as a phenomenon of centralizing power and authority.
Right.
Certainly not decentralization. So walk us through what that regionally decentralized means.
Right. You are absolutely correct that totalitarianism means centralization. That's the highest degree of centralization. But here, the matter is a highly centralized regime. How would that operate in practice? So here, the totalitarianism means that you have a party which penetrates every corner of society and controls everything of a society. Then that would include the ideology and organization and politics and the personnel. But then concretely for a empire like China, it's gigantic. So in practice, how would this highly centralized regime operate? Actually, the Chinese way of operating is that keeping the most centralized regime untouched, then the concrete administrative matters are going to be delegated to the local party state apparatus. So these are parties, so the party controls. Here, really the key is about the division of labor. So in the Soviet model, the division of labor is at the central level. So you have a division of labor among ministries. So every ministry is specialized in one function, and all the firms in Soviet Union are going to be directly controlled by ministries. But in China, it's not operating in that way. So here, you have a provincial level government, party state apparatus, so you have a city level, you have county level, you have a township level party state apparatus. And at each level, particularly provincial, city, and county, each level is self-contained. So you don't have a division of labor at each local level. And then you have firms, and this local party state apparatus are going to control firms at their level. So in that way, that actually this kind of arrangement make the Chinese type of totalitarianism is much more flexible, much more effective, and much more resilient. And that is part of the reason that after the collapse of the Soviet Union, the Chinese totalitarian regime could retain.
Would it work to substitute delegated for decentralized?
Actually, to avoid confusions, in my latest version of the of the manuscript, so after its print, you will see, I changed the term. I would not call that as regionally decentralized totalitarianism. Instead, I call that as regionally administered totalitarianism. So to avoid the term decentralization. But indeed, decentralization was the word being used by the Chinese communists. And not only the Chinese, Gorbachev, in his in his reform program, he actually repeatedly talked about the decentralization. That's a part of the reason. Mm-hmm. So in my earlier version, I borrowed these words from these communist leaders, but conceptually it could make a confusion.
Well, and you get a better acronym now. It used to be RDT, now you get RAT, R-A-T.
Yeah, exactly.
Now I want to bring these together, and I've intentionally waited on asking you to just lay out the main argument of the book because I first wanted to lay some groundwork.
Yeah,
but I wonder
yeah.
if you can now bring these two together.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, what is the puzzle
right.
that you were explaining with this, and how does sort of institutional genes framework
right.
and regionally administered totalitarianism,
right.
how do those fit together in the thesis?
Right, right. So this, first, let me just briefly talk about how this regime being evolved, being established. So the number one step was to establish a Soviet type of totalitarian regime. So that happened starting from 1931, instead of usually people will say PRC. PRC started from 1949. So in 1931, the Chinese Communist Party, under the leadership of the Comintern, which is a agent of Soviet Union Communist Party, so under the leadership of Comintern, the Chinese Communist Party established the Chinese Soviet Republic, in 1931. So that is the first Soviet regime in China. And later, the PRC is simply an extension and expansion of the existing Soviet, the Chinese Soviet Republic. So then up to the mid-1950s, China has accomplished replicating the Soviet type of regime in the whole continental China. But then starting from 1958, Mao Zedong launched this so-called Great Leap Forward campaign, which actually is the first wave of moving China away from the Soviet model. So in that Great Leap Forward campaign, the central planning was completely abandoned. Instead, the central planning was replaced by these regional administrations. And then the Great Leap Forward ended up with a great failure, with nearly 40 million people died of the famine caused by the chaos of this first wave of changing regime. And then the Cultural Revolution, it was the second wave of consolidating this new regime established in the Great Leap Forward. So then at the end of the Cultural Revolution, this new regime has been consolidated, which is the foundation of the post-Mao reform. So the reason the post-Mao reform could perform the reform so effectively comparing with the counterparts in Soviet Union and in Central Eastern European communist regimes is exactly because the Chinese regime has been already transformed into this much more flexible format of totalitarianism.
The regionally administered totalitarianism model makes sense to me today. We've seen reaffirmation of the Leninist traits in the party over the last decade under Xi Jinping. Right. It makes less sense to me if I'm thinking about the 2000s, for example, or really sort of the late 1990s. I was living in China for much of the 2000s. Right. There was a profound sense of atrophy in the Leninist impulses and muscles of of the party. Does the RAT model fit then, or do you have a different conception in mind for certain moments in the party's trajectory?
Right. It's a great question. Indeed, associated with the economic reform, an essential part of this success of the reform is the private sector. So the reason under the communist rule, the private sector could grow that fast and could become the major part of the Chinese economy was exactly because of this regional administration. So all the regional party state apparatus had strong incentives to grow fast. And for implementing their aim of growing, they allowed for private firms to grow. So when the private firms grow, and then associated with the private firms, you have a huge amount of NGOs growing as well. So then you had a sort of civil society emerging from China. So under that kind of situation, and also in parallel to all of this, there was a relaxing of the control over ideology. So you have economics, political science, sociology, anthropology, legal theories, all coming from the West into the Chinese university, into their curriculum, formal curriculum. So in that sense, in that period of time, China was moving towards a kind of authoritarian regime. So the so-called authoritarian regime compared with totalitarianism means that there is a limited pluralism. So this limited pluralism made people have this kind of feeling that it's possible. So if China is moving towards authoritarianism, if eventually China became an authoritarian regime, then China is going to replicate what Taiwan has done, what South Korea has done. But here the key point is that it was under the control of a communist party, and the Communist Party was actually highly alerted about this moving towards an authoritarian regime. Concretely, that alarm started from the very beginning of the 21st century, when the private firms were growing so fast, and most of the private firms did not have party sales. Most entrepreneurs were not party members, and which means that supposedly in a totalitarian regime, the Communist Party controls everything. But now you have the majority of employees are working in private firms, and these firms don't have party style, means the party is losing control. So the party got highly alerted about this situation. So then they have designed the strategies to regain the control. And eventually, we had this recent 10 years of reversal. These are all the efforts of regaining the control.
Later on in the discussion, I want to come back to that last point you made, because I want to ask you where you think China's political trajectory goes from here.
Right.
But I wanted to circle back to, a good chunk of your book is actually a historical exploration of paths taken and paths not taken.
Right.
And, two forces that you identify as fundamentally critical to China's current political trajectory are the imperial system, and also, of course, as you've mentioned several times, the importation of Soviet governance technology. One thing you talk about in the book is what you call this great institutional divergence. But one interesting thing is, if we were looking at the intellectual discussions happening in China, at the end of the 19th century, beginning of the early 20th century, I think we could make a convincing case that China is heading towards some type of liberal constitutional monarchy, something where you have a regime type embedded in a constitutional system, right? Intellectuals like Liang Qichao, Yan Fu, Chen Du, sort of Marxists like Chen Duxiu. If it's 1918, this is a very liberal, tolerant, humanistic sort of form of Marxism that is being discussed. How do you explain how we go from Liang Qichao and the Hundred Days Reform and the possibilities of some form of constitutional government to, several decades later, the fact that, arguably one of the dominant intellectual movements is about building, borrowing from the Soviet Union, and ends up building a sort of totalitarian system. Where did that movement towards constitutionalism lose its way, and why did the Soviet governance technology end up replicating so effectively?
Right. Yeah, actually, one of the major reasons that I bothered to develop this concept of institutional genes is to understand this kind of historical trajectories. So my explanation is that to transform from the Chinese Empire or this Chinese type of imperial system into constitutional democracy actually requires certain institutional genes. And these institutional genes would include solid private ownership, which means that you have a large number of citizens who have private property and who are consciously protecting their rights. So only with that kind of a condition, so I call that as institutional genes, then you have a social consensus that individuals have their rights. And also, this social consensus is going to be associated with their power. Power means that they are able to organize themselves and to make their voice and to push forward. So without these conditions, actually a top-down push for in the direction of constitutionalism or democracy would not work. So if we look at history, there's no that kind of movement succeeded in history. So you have to have this bottom-up force. So I call that as institutional genes, but China did not have. And the Chinese institutional genes, what I identified, are the Chinese empire, the imperial institution, and also another institutional gene necessary for establishing a totalitarian party is the secret political organizations. So in these two institutional genes, China has been very strong. And then I identified the communist totalitarian regime in Soviet Union, in Soviet Russia. So what are the institutional genes for that? So I identified three. The number one is the imperial system in Russia. The number two is the secret organization. The number three is the Russian orthodoxy. So among the three institutional genes, China shared two. So the only thing China was missing was the Russian orthodoxy. So that actually is important. And that is why the Comintern, the impact of Comintern is necessary. It's a necessary condition for China to be converted into a totalitarian regime. So China had a strong foundation, strong institutional genes for adapting totalitarianism. So and then you have this Comintern coming to China and established the Chinese Communist Party by them. And then they not only propagated the ideology, they also trained the Chinese how to organize this totalitarian party. So not only the Chinese communists, including the Kuomintang, they were all trained by the Comintern, and also militarily, they were trained by the Comintern. So then with this help, but so sometimes people may say that it was completely due to the effort of Comintern. That is wrong, because the Comintern actually worked everywhere. And their major target was Germany and Western Europe. But they failed everywhere. But they succeeded greatly in China. The reason is because China had the institutional genes for developing that kind of institution. But in Western Europe, there was no such institutional genes for them to succeed.
Let me use that as a segue to, I want to spend some time asking you about where you think China goes from here. And I think if I can pick up on one thread, one of the things as a lay student that I don't understand always, though, is it seems like sometimes the explanation you just had can lead to this sort of institutional determinacy, because change is never possible, because China emerged from a certain historical context, as you say, more fertile for potentially autocratic governance, and therefore that's just the permanent trajectory of China. Yet, obviously, China has seen massive swings and changes even over the last four decades. I take your point that Deng Xiaoping, you know, Deng Lichun, Hu Chaomu, you know, put in place the four cardinal principles, and Deng had limits to how far he was willing to reform. But nonetheless, I don't think anyone was predicting in 1977 that China would go in the direction that it went, right? I think that, and certainly conservatives in the party were very worried about the trajectory. So How do you fit change within a context of path dependency and the weight of history on shaping institutional choices? The reason I'm asking this, because I want to get to the next question, which is change in the future possible? But first on this one, how is any change possible given your argument that you just made?
Right, okay, great. We mentioned about the changes during the reform. So we mentioned very fast growth of a private sector. And that actually not only benefited to the growth of the economy, not only saved the communist regime in China, but also at the same time, I would argue that new institutional genes have been emerged during that process. So what are these new institutional genes? These are private ownership. These are the consciousness of many individuals in China with their rights. So they have the conscience about their rights. So they work very hard, try to protect their private rights. So it includes property rights and other aspects of human rights. And we also see that there were huge amount of lawyers help the people to protect their rights. And there were also civil society operating in China, try to help people to protect their rights or to improve social welfare. So all of these, I regard them as new institutional genes. And these new institutional genes are the necessary conditions for China to move forward towards democracy. So eventually, if someday China could change into a more positive direction, that is the foundation. But the sadness is that because the Communist Party is still controlling society, and the Communist Party has this consciousness of protecting their regime, and they have identified all of these new institutional genes as the foundation of shaking up their regime. So they have been alerted actually 20 years ago. There were publications by the party saying that preventing the color revolution, preventing the peaceful evolution, these are the highest priority. And the foundations for these kind of things are this private ownership and NGOs and civil society and all the discussions about human rights, discussions about rule of law, discussions about independent judiciary, discussions about constitutionalism. So nowadays, all of these terms are banned. The reason these are banned is exactly because these are the conditions for growing of the new institutional genes. So then here you see this two forces are fighting. So in that sense, I would not regard the evolution of history is deterministic. So it's not deterministic, but the concept of institutional genes is helpful for us to know the conditions of transformation.
I think I know that the answer will be somewhat pessimistic, but I want to now ask you, so given that, so the new institutional genes emerged as a potential accidental byproduct of economic reforms the party made out of the necessity of self-preservation.
Right.
So that's pillar one of the argument. Those new institutional genes then provoked the creation of antibodies I'll try to stay with the biological. I think I'm going to run out because I don't know many more terms, but antibodies within the party system, which saw these new institutional genes as, and their replication as a threat to the solidity and resilience of the party. And that simplified story that maybe starts in 2008, 2009, you know, accelerates under Xi Jinping, and that's where we are today. Right. Okay, so that's argument two. So third argument then is prospect for changes in China's political trajectory.
Right.
So I think, you know, question one is, if we've seen that the party in the past has been willing to take on significant political risk in the name of self-preservation, and we could say that the reform and opening plan was a calculated risk. As you know, as you said, Deng Xiaoping was aware of some of the possibility of these new institutional genes.
Yes.
Spiritual pollution, right? You know,
exactly.
You're going to have to let a few flies in.
Yes.
You know, like, so they were aware of this, and yet they still went ahead with it. And actually, you know, Deng and people like Hu Yaobang and Zhao Ziyang had to wage political bureaucratic war to open up space for the reforms.
Right.
So that would seem to indicate to me that self-preservation can push the Communist Party to do things on the left and on the right.
Right.
Right. So what prospect is there if we think about China's current economic trajectory and we imagine that the slowdown is going to be a secular phenomenon? Do you imagine, or could you imagine, a point where, not because Xi Jinping, you know, reads F.A. Hayek and gets the liberal bug, but simply because for reasons of self-preservation, they need to make a fundamental change.
Right.
And in the economic trajectory, I don't want to say move back to a reformist trajectory, but something that is more market tolerant. Do you see that as possible under the current leadership, given that idea that self-preservation means the party will do all sorts of things to save itself?
Right. Yeah. So here, indeed, this totalitarian party is in self-contradiction, because definitely their objective is to preserving their power. So that's the ultimate goal. But for fulfilling that goal, they have to keep the economy growing. Otherwise, their theory is a Marxist theory. So according to Marxist theory, so if the growth of that particular type of institution is slower than the capitalist economy, then it's a proof of inferior. So you don't want to prove that you are failing. So that's for legitimacy issue. And actually, even more urgent than legitimacy is social stability. So when the economy is failing, then they face pressures of instability. So for all of these reasons, keeping the economy growing is necessary. But keeping the economy growing is a very, very difficult task to the Chinese Communist Party if they worry so much about the private sector, and they worry so much about the capitalist spirit. So to keep the economy growing, they rely on private sector. They rely on capitalist spirit. But all of these are in contradiction to the party's ideology and to the totalitarian regime. But they are in deep contradiction. But if they control, if they choose the trajectory of controlling they thought that is safer politically, then almost for sure that the economy is going to decline and to decline further. But when the economy decline further, then it's going to destabilize the whole society. So when the whole society is destabilized, what do they do? So then basically you have two possibilities. So one possibility is the trajectory of North Korea. So that is a model. And actually the trajectory of North Korea, China itself experienced a similar period of time, particularly the Great Leap Forward and the Cultural Revolution. So the party controls society very tightly and purge huge amount of people within its own people. So that possibility cannot be ruled out. And then the other possibility is that the Communist Party may force to make a change. So there were two lessons the Chinese Communist Party learned from Soviet Union, from the collapse of Soviet Union. The lesson number one is the failure of economic reform. So actually, currently, China is in that trajectory. It's a failing. And the other major lesson they learned from Soviet Union was the emergence of Gorbachev. Actually, it's not a person. It's emergence of that type of leadership. And so if we look at what Gorbachev had done, Gorbachev did not mean to dissolve Soviet Union. Gorbachev tried every best to preserve Soviet Union, to preserve a communist regime. And what Gorbachev actually called for was exactly Lenin's new economic policy. So we cannot rule that out. So you might have a new generation of Chinese communist leadership try to redo the Leninist new economic policy. People may call that as Deng Xiaoping. But then here, there is another challenge to the Chinese communists. The challenge is that a very important reason that Deng Xiaoping could go that far, there were two reasons. One was the conflict between China and the Soviet Union, and the United States and the whole West tried to use China as a leverage to play against the Soviet Union. At that time, Soviet Union was the major enemy, but not anymore. So in today's geopolitics, and also when the Chinese Communist revealed its nature that is the same as the Soviet Communist Party, so then geopolitically there is no leverage. Mm. And then the other issue is that the reason Deng Xiaoping could go that far was because of the Cultural Revolution. So the Cultural Revolution gave him the credit, and also the Cultural Revolution made a very large army prepared for Deng Xiaoping. This large army prepared for him, what I mean is those bureaucrats, the party state apparatus bureaucrats being purged during the Cultural Revolution, but not anymore. So if in case there was a new leadership try to redo the reform, the new reform is going to be very, very difficult, very, very difficult to convince not only outside the world, but also within China.
Just a third factor is, in some sense, only Deng Xiaoping you needed Deng Xiaoping to push through the reforms in addition to the geopolitical dynamics and the historical.
Right.
There is no figure like Deng Xiaoping the sense of someone who was on the Long March, had fought against the Japanese, had widespread, had served in state capacity, in party positions, had widespread credibility across the entire political system, even though he was purged. There are no Chen Yuns, there are no Deng Xiaopings, Ye Jianyings, are none of these figures in the party today. It's Tai Chi and Wang Huning. It's, even if we imagine the space opened up, it's hard to imagine someone who would have credibility right. across the system, who could mobilize a coalition, who could push against vested interests. I had a whole bunch of other questions I was going to ask you, but I just realized we're at the end of the hour. But actually, this is just an advertisement for how good the book will be, and also for how important it is, because I think it's clear China's entered a new paradigm, and our mental map of China, which certainly for me is reform and opening, no longer describes the territory.
Right.
And we now have to, I think, sharpen our analytical tools to understand where right. China's political system is going,
right. Right.
And do so, you know, I think informed by history, but also by, you know, thinkers like yourself who are helping give us tools and frameworks to explore this just extraordinarily important topic. So I want to thank you for coming here today. I want to thank you for again, all your work, which has taught me so much over the decades as I've tried to be a student of China. And I'm really looking forward to the book when it's published later this year.
Thank you so much for these stimulating questions and the great comments.
Thank you.
If you enjoyed this podcast, check out our larger suite of CSIS podcasts, from Into Africa, The Asia Chessboard, China Power, The Trade Guys, Smart Women, Smart Power, and more. You can listen to them all on major streaming platforms like iTunes and Spotify. Visit csis.org/podcasts to see our full catalog.